From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. A new study out last week says that premature babies, when actively treated, can sometimes survive at just 22 weeks from conception. But babies this young and small, sometimes just 1 pound, are at great risk. It's hard to survive, and if they do survive, there can be problems. Cerebral palsy, blindness, learning issues. This hour on Point, extreme preemies and the risks, rewards, and costs of survival. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Have you had a baby this young, this early? Did you have a tough conversation in the neonatal unit with your doctor about the choices in front of you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Iowa City, Iowa, is Dr. Edward Bell. He's a neonatologist, professor of pediatrics and neonatology at the University of Iowa, and co-author of the study Between Hospital Variation in Treatment and Outcomes in Extremely Preterm Infants, published just last week in the New England Journal of Medicine. Dr. Bell, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Your study has turned a lot of heads. These numbers are getting so low, 23 weeks, 22 weeks. What exactly did you look at in this study? What did you find?
Well, let me begin by saying this is the work of many people in a large network of hospitals, the NICHD Neonatal Research Network. We included data from 24 hospitals around the U.S., The first author I should mention is Matt Rashavi, who's a medical student who's graduating later this week. We looked at the difference between hospitals in the approach to care of babies at these very early gestations. There's been a lot of attention in the press about the fact that babies at 22 and 23 weeks can survive and can even have good outcomes, but we're not the first to show this. This has been known for years, and other people have shown this before. But I think ours was the first study to systematically look at the difference among hospitals in their approach to the care of babies at these very early gestational ages.
The 24-week boundary was the one that is sort of stuck in a lot of minds. What percentage of the hospitals you looked at are willing to try to save a baby born at 23 weeks or 22 weeks?
Let me see if I can find that quickly.
We're looking through a big study here. I thought you would have a kind of a general idea of how common that is.
Well, I can tell you quickly that there are hospitals in the study that treated no babies at 22 weeks and some that treated all babies at 22 weeks. Overall, the number was about a quarter of babies at 22 weeks were actively treated.
Can you describe what it means to actively treat a preemie at 22 or 23 weeks before the birth and after the birth? We're talking about months of treatment here.
We defined active treatment as any medical treatment that was intended to preserve the life of the baby. So this included mainly support of the breathing, providing medications, anything that was more than just comfort care, which, of course, all babies receive.
This is far more than comfort care, though, right? I mean, typically...
Yes.
Can you describe what the care is like when a baby is born this young?
Well, the care that these babies received that we defined as active treatment is really the standard neonatal intensive care that's provided to all very premature babies. And typically, this will include supportive breathing. It may include insertion of a breathing tube into the windpipe and attaching this tube to a breathing machine to help with the breathing. We often will give a medication through this tube into the lungs to help replace a natural chemical that's not yet being produced at these very early gestations. We'll have to provide artificial means of feeding the babies because they're not big and strong enough to feed the natural way will have to often give antibiotics and other medications to help the babies. We have to provide an artificial support of the temperature environment to help the baby stay warm.
And what about the prognosis for these preemies? If it's 22 weeks, if it's 23 weeks, what percentage survive? What percentage, you say they can have good outcomes, what percentage will grow up to full healthy capacity in lives?
Well, this is a really important aspect of the study, because it depends whether you include just the babies who are actively treated or all the babies. And so it's very important in understanding, if you're looking at the survival statistics, exactly which babies are included. For the 22-week babies in our study, the survival rate was only 5% if you include all babies. But if you limit it to the babies who are actively treated, it was 23%. And for 23-week babies, the survival among all babies was 24%, but if you look just at those who were actively treated, it was 33%. So one very important take-home lesson from this research is that if the doctors are presenting data to the woman who comes in very preterm labor and her partner, it's very important to understand whether the statistics being provided include all babies for whom no effort was made to treat the baby.
Still, with full effort, you're talking about 23% survival rate at 22 weeks, 33% at 23 weeks.
Right.
Are you with this, Dr. Bell? Are you, in effect, proposing a new lower boundary or a new standard by which hospitals, are you suggesting they should operate? You've got very preterm birth, 22 or 23 weeks. Last year, you might not have taken all measures to save that baby. This year, are you suggesting you should, the hospital should?
Well, I'm not in a position to make such a recommendation. In fact, I was the principal author of the American Academy of Pediatrics statement in 2007 on non-initiation and withdrawal of treatment of high-risk infants. And we specifically avoided using a gestational age threshold in making those recommendations for a number of reasons. First of all, there are other factors besides gestational age that have an important influence on the baby's chance of survival, such as the gender of the baby. Did the mother receive steroid treatments before the baby was born? Is it a single baby, or is the baby a twin or a triplet, and other factors? Gestational age is a convenient starting place for this conversation, but it's not the whole story. Secondly, the threshold of viability, as we call it, is a moving target, and it has, during my professional career, it has moved approximately a week earlier every decade. And so we have to be very careful about drawing a line in the sand and saying this is the point at which treatment is appropriate, because if we had done this 30 years ago, we would still not be treating any babies before 26 weeks. And finally, there is a difference from center to center, certainly around the world, but even within the United States, in the outcomes that are achievable. But it's very important for centers to look at their own outcomes and to look at these new results and to take them into consideration and to revisit their own policies and practices. I guess that's what we hope would come from this study.
We're going to look at the whole big picture of going very aggressively to treat preemies born at just 22 or 23 weeks of gestational age. Dr. Edward Bell is one of the authors of a big new study just out last week on what hospitals are doing on this front. And of course, it can become an issue for a family for potential parents in a big, big hurry. Dr. Bell, we've got callers for you. Jennifer in Charleston, South Carolina. Jennifer, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. What's your story?
I want to apologize. This is kind of difficult for me to talk about. In 2012, I actually suddenly had to give birth. I had an emergency C-section because my daughter was having some heart trouble in the womb, and she was born at 22 and a half weeks gestation.
Mm-hmm.
Fortunately, I do live in Charleston, South Carolina, and I had access to MUSC where I was rushed, and that's where the procedure was done. And they really laid all the options out on the table, and they've come very far in their NICU in treating babies that are born that early. And I really think that the most important thing is that the doctors and nurses actually sit down and weigh out all the options with the mother and the father or whomever.
How did it work out for you, Jennifer?
She lived for 7 days. On the seventh day, she did have a lot of complications from being born that early. Her viability wasn't the best when she was born. She wasn't even a pound. She was 14 and a half ounces. There were a lot of things that happened with her lungs. She had a bleed in her brain, things like that. And on the seventh day, we were, you know, they gave us the option to remove life support and everything. That really was the better option, just because they did lay out all of the problems that she would have later in life.
And I'm sorry you lost her. Are you glad that you tried, Jennifer?
Oh, I have no regrets for my choice. A lot of people, including family members, unfortunately, do tell us that we made the wrong choice constantly. But I think given the opportunity, given all the options that we were given at that time, and it was very sudden, and we were very young. We were 24.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm glad that we did it, and I'm glad that the doctors gave us all the options that they did. And my point is that I think that everyone needs to make their own decision, and I was very happy that
We got a break right here. Jennifer, stick with us. This is On Point. We're looking at preemies. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about advanced medical care, pushing the point of viability for preemies, prematurely born babies, down sometimes to 23, even 22 weeks of gestation. And looking at the implications of that for medicine, for parents, for infants, for society, Dr. Edward Bell is with us from Iowa City, professor of pediatrics and neonatology at the University of Iowa, one of the authors of a big new report out last week looking at a lot of hospitals and how they're handling this. Jennifer, if you're still with us from Charleston, it was 22 and a half weeks. You were 24 years old. This was probably very surprising territory you found yourself on. You tried with the hospital for 7 days and then ultimately lost that infant. And I just want to be sure, because we ran into the break there, that we understand your takeaway from this experience, Jennifer.
I think the most important thing is that I know it's a tough decision for everyone to go into, like, what the best treatment options are. And I think it's a case-by-case basis. And my thing is, I was very thankful for the doctors and nurses that we came in contact with and how supportive they were of us, but they were still very real with us about the future and what we were actually doing. Because, like I said, we were very young and impressionable, and we had people telling us, you know, you see those things on social media, this baby was born this early and it turned out okay. It doesn't always turn out okay, and I was very appreciative that people were, you know, that real with us.
If they described to you that how this might go, it could go well, could go poorly, were you and your husband or the father prepared to take on that risk and responsibility that would come if the child did have long-term problems?
I don't think anyone is really prepared for any of those situations. And we did what was right for us at that point, mm-hmm. but it just got to the point where we saw that the quality of life was going to be too poor for us to proceed any further.
Jennifer, I'm grateful to
you. We were just doing it for ourselves at that point, and it just seemed too selfish.
I'm grateful to you for sharing that story with us. We can all hear what a tough time that must have been. And it's good of you to help other people get some insight into what it feels like to be right in the middle of that. Thank you for calling, Jennifer.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
Dr. Bell in Iowa City, please stand by. With us right now from Salt Lake City, Utah, is Dr. Mark Mercurio. He's director of the Program for Biomedical Ethics at Yale School of Medicine, professor of pediatrics, chief of perinatal medicine at Yale School of Medicine. Dr. Mercurio, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
We're getting into low numbers here. We've been there for a while, I guess, but people getting focused on this and what it means if more hospitals are intervening to save babies so very young. When you begin to look at this as an ethicist, what's most important here? Is there an ethical duty to save that baby? Is there an ethical duty to talk to the parents about what the child's life may be, if indeed it survives? What's the ethical construct you put around this decision?
Well, I would say the ethical construct centers around two big questions. The first question is, who should make this decision? And the second one is, on what basis should the decision be made? And we can certainly get into that. That could include the benefits and burdens of the child, could include the rights of the child, the rights of the parents, the obligations of the physician and others, allocations of resources, justice, many things. So those are the two questions that I think should be approached in that way. I think that once the question has been identified, though, about what we should do for a particular child, the conversation then should really begin with a fair and honest and frank discussion of the available data. And that's where I think this study is very helpful. Now, again, as Ed Bell pointed out, this is actually not new information that babies at 22 weeks can survive. That's been around for many years. But this paper, I think, was a very helpful piece of work in further illuminating the data.
What data jumps out to you, Dr. Mercurio?
I think the data that jumps out to me most is that the way they nicely separated the survival of all comers at a given gestational age and the survival for those who received the active intervention. So the number that you see or hear, the 5% survival at 23 weeks, is something that has been published for years. What's gotten much less attention, but what's been actually been out there for years from the Neonatal Research Network and others, is that number can sometimes be deceptive. If the question parents ask is, well, what are the chances of survival? And if we say, well, the chances of survival are 6%, what they're really asking is not what is the overall survival of all babies born at this gestational age. What they're really asking, I think, or what the relevant question is, what would be the chances of survival if we tried? That's a very different question. If we never try, of course, the survival is zero. The question is, what if we tried for my particular child? And so, I mean, two points should be made. One is that those answers are very different. And I think we have to be honest first with ourselves and then with the parents about that number. So that difference in numbers, 6% survival overall, 23% survival among those who received the active intervention. Those are very different numbers. So I think 23% is closer to the honest answer to the relevant question. But within 22 weeks, there's going to be great variability. It's going to depend on the gender of the child, the size of the child, and other things. And so that number, 23%, is not carved in stone either. But I think that difference between the overall survival and the survival when resuscitation was attempted, when active intervention was tried, that big difference. At 22 and 23 weeks, you see in the paper, by 24 weeks, there's not much difference because by 24 weeks, almost everybody's trying.
Dr. Bell, genders come up a couple of times here. Females are more likely to survive at a very young gestational age than males. Why is that?
We don't completely understand why, but females have a biological advantage. The female fetus matures faster than the male by about a week, just as female adolescents reach puberty earlier than males.
Dr. Mercurio, when you look at full-term babies that go the full 9 months, what percentage of those live?
Oh, like this, something far in excess of 98%, something like that. I mean, of the babies who are born at term, you're asking?
Yes.
Yes, nearly all of those babies are going to live. More than 95%. I couldn't give you an exact number.
So how do we look at the ethics then? If it go full term and it's gets up close to 100%, we're talking 22 or 23 weeks, and it may be down at with active intervention, it's still only 23% at 22 or 33% at 23. Take us into that decision then. If it's still just a quarter or a third surviving, is it obvious when or whether active intervention is appropriate?
To me, it's not obvious, no. To me, it's certainly not obvious. At the borderline viability, a child at 22 or 23 weeks, it's not obvious what should be done. Because that if you look at this, that you say, so if five children, even if we have a survival of 20%, say, if so we're going to put five children through this, five babies through this, so that one can survive, and then perhaps a third of those survivors are going to be left with severe disability. So it's not obvious by any means. So then the question is, okay, if we recognize that it's not at all obvious, we have to weigh the benefits and the burdens to the child as well as other things. Then we have to say, okay, so how are we going to go about making that decision? And at what point should parents be given latitude? I favor that if there's a chance of survival, if there's a reasonable chance of survival, even if low, I think parents should be very much a part of that conversation. And I think your caller certainly reflected that she appreciated that she was given the information and was given the ability to participate in the conversation. There are some who would say at 22 weeks, for example, parents should not be a part of conversation, that this should simply be not be done because the survival is so low, because the costs, both short-term and long-term, can be so high. So that's – it's not at all obvious to me, no. I think that the real question is how do we go about deciding? And I think that a mistake would be to go about deciding based on what we've done in the past, you know, what we were taught. I think that we go about deciding by taking a good look at the data, weighing all the relevant ethical factors and the rights of everyone involved, and then together making a decision based on that.
It's such a fraught moment. You have a pregnancy. You have all the hopes and dreams of the mother and father and the extended family. And then suddenly it's coming too early. Do people sit down and really have candid conversations? You say if that infant survives, one third may have severe disabilities. Like what?
Well, the disabilities these kids can be left with are significant cognitive deficits, a low IQ, cerebral palsy, sometimes severe. Some of these children are going to have visual problems. Some of them will be blind, but a small minority of them will be blind, but it's possible, and hearing deficits, among others. But those are the major ones that we tend to look at and are the major ones we're concerned about. This is absolutely a very difficult moment for parents. And you talk about sitting down and having a conversation. Mm-hmm. You have to understand that sometimes we have hours or days to have these conversations, and sometimes these conversations have to happen very quickly, depending on how quickly the baby's going to be born. Decisions have to be made about whether or not to try to resuscitate. I think that the case of the caller points out, however, that decision that's made at the moment of birth about whether or not to attempt resuscitation and to provide intensive care measures, that decision is not one isolated decision. Okay, now the choice has been made and we're done talking. I got the sense from Jennifer, and certainly it's the case in our unit and I think in units throughout the country, that it's an ongoing conversation. So indeed, if it reaches a point where the prognosis is further clarified, that at that point decisions can be made, in fact, and are made, as was the case in Jennifer's family, to say, okay, we've tried this. It's not working out as well as we'd hoped, so it's a reasonable thing now to stop. So it's not a one-time decision. Of course, it's a one-time decision. Mm-hmm. If the decision is made not to intervene, one can't go back a day later and change one's mind. But the decision to try is not a one-time decision, which then one stays with indefinitely.
Dr. Bell, from your awareness, maybe from the study, how diverse are hospital policies about how they respond when a baby's being born at 22 or 23 weeks? Are there fairly standard responses in terms of engagement with the parents, the conversation that takes place there, what they push for or toward, or are they all over the map?
Our study can't really provide data on hospital policies. We weren't able to delve into the reasons for the wide variation in active treatment rate, but I can tell you that there are organizations in the U.S., Canada, the U.K., and Europe who have made official recommendations on how these things should be managed at various gestational ages. And the Canadian Pediatric Society, for example, has recommended that intervention should not be taken at 22 weeks gestation. And the American organizations, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and the American Academy of Pediatrics have just last year issued a recommendation that aggressive newborn resuscitation is not recommended at 22 weeks unless considered potentially viable based on individual circumstances. And that's an important qualifier because I think it really does come down to looking at these patients on a case-by-case basis. I think Jennifer hit the nail on the head when she said that this was done with a careful conversation with between the family and the physicians. I think that's how it has to be done, especially at 22 weeks, but also at 23 and 24 weeks.
Dennis in Appleton, Wisconsin. Dennis, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Our daughter had to have an emergency C-section. The baby was about 23 weeks. The baby spent 87 days in the NICU. That was for, she'll be three next week. She appears to be a healthy girl. Everything worked out great. But I'm just wondering if after this amount of time, could there still be complications or things show up?
We'll look at that, Dennis. I appreciate your call. The NICU, the neonatal intensive care unit, 87 days. That's a long time there. Let me turn to St. Paul, Minnesota, and Dr. Jennifer Needle, if I may, a pediatric intensive care physician, assistant professor at pediatric critical care at the University of Minnesota Medical School. Dr. Needle, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So here's a concerned grandfather calling in. You heard 23 weeks his granddaughter was born, 87 days in the intensive care unit there. Now she's three and appears to be doing well. And we wish her the very, very best. In your experience, how long does it take to know whether there may be long-term impacts of that kind of early birth, Dr. Needle?
Well, I think it's relatively clear from the literature that there may be subtle cognitive and learning disabilities that children acquire due to extreme prematurity that may not be detected until school age. The majority of children that have medical issues after they're discharged from the NICU tend to have them in the first couple years of life. So in the sense of this caller's granddaughter, the fact that she's three and has hopefully been able to stay out of the hospital since her discharge from the NICU, that portends a good prognosis for her from a physical perspective. The neonatal community has done an excellent job of doing long-term neurodevelopmental follow-up of these children. And so hopefully this child is involved in one of those programs and they can utilize testing to determine whether she has any special needs as she gets closer to school age.
Do you have the sense, Dr. Needle, that hospitals are being fully transparent with parents and their families, extended families possibly, in this, what almost always must present as an emergency situation? Suddenly a pregnancy is, you know, the baby's being born, it's way early, people are emotional, there's so much to take on board. Are hospitals, as a general rule, being completely transparent with all these layers of potential implications that families face?
So I'm a specialist in the pediatric intensive care unit, so I take care of these children once they survive their NICU course and graduate from the NICU if, unfortunately, they need to be readmitted to an intensive care unit. My sense from my neonatology colleagues, at least, is that these conversations are incredibly thoughtful from the perspective of the neonatologist. And I think the bigger question with regard to transparency is how we communicate the gray area of decisions like these. And it's relevant to extremes of prematurity, but it's also relevant to issues such as whether or not we perform CPR or whether or not we undergo surgery with a high risk of mortality and subsequent illness. So I think the issue is how physicians communicate the uncertainty that the medical community experiences in cases like this.
Hi, Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about advanced medical care, pushing the point of viability for preemies, prematurely born babies, down now to 23, even 22 weeks of gestation, and looking at the implications of that for medicine, for parents, for infants, for society. Dr. Edward Bell, one of the authors of a new study out last week, looking at between-hospital variation in treatment and outcomes in extremely preterm infants, published in the New England Journal of Medicine, getting a fair amount of attention, joins us from Iowa City. Dr. Mark Mercurio is with us from Salt Lake City, Utah. He's director of the Program for Biomedical Ethics at Yale School of Medicine. And from St. Paul, Minnesota, Dr. Jennifer Needle is here, a pediatric intensive care physician and assistant professor there at University of Minnesota Medical School. A lot of experience between these guests and a lot from our listeners as well, as we're hearing. People responding online, here's Karen says, 27 years ago, I had a 25-week baby in Burlington, Vermont. She is now a happy, independent occupational therapist. That's a great story. Of course, there's a difference between 25 and 22, but as Dr. Bell says, that line moves and changes. But there are other stories here, though. Here's another listener who writes, my child was born at 27 weeks. He's now 8 years old, and we've had many struggles. He appears normal to many, but he has autistic behaviors. He struggles with social skills and math, even how to take a bath. We wonder how happy he is. It's a big responsibility, whatever the decision here. Mark Mercurio, there in Salt Lake City, you said there's many ways of looking first at who should decide, but then also on what basis we decide. You mentioned benefits and burdens to the child. Let's start there. How do you stack those up and weigh them?
Well, that's obviously a very subjective judgment. We can look at extreme cases and see the obvious, where if the child has to go through something that's got a mild or moderate amount of pain, but it has, and it's very likely to save the child's life and lead to an excellent quality of life, we would say clearly the benefits of that treatment outweigh the burdens. At the other extreme, there are some times when a child is clearly dying and nothing we're going to do is going to save the child. And so if someone suggests a painful procedure, for example, one would argue that, well, the burdens to the child outweigh the possible benefit, and so that's not appropriate. And then there's going to be an area in the middle where it's very subjective. So if a child has, picking a number of, if we look, and again, it's not just about gestational age, and it's important. It's important to recognize that. For example, a large girl at 22 weeks may have a better prognosis than a smaller boy at 23 weeks. So to simply draw a line at 23 or 22 weeks is not necessarily the wisest course. But that said, for any particular child, if we said there was a 1 in 4 chance of survival, for example, and of those kids, 1 out of 3 may be left with a severe impairment, then does the benefit of taking that chance of going through those months in the intensive care unit, does it outweigh the burden? I think that it's going to be a spectrum. At 22 and 23 weeks, I think that's a difficult judgment. Because it's a difficult judgment and because it's subjective, I think the opinions of the parents should matter.
And there's more I want to look at there. A couple of callers first, if I may. Anita in Moyock, North Carolina. Anita, you're on. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Yeah, my niece was born emergency C-section at 22 weeks. You could see her skeleton. She was so transparent. She is 4 years old now. She's healthy. The only problem we can tell is that sometimes she shakes a little bit in her hand. And she is a little bit behind the other children. But other than that, she's got a great personality. She's funny. And so it was a blessing, really.
A niece who came through after 22 weeks, and you described the way you see her and she interacts in class. Anita, I appreciate that. One more right here. Lisa in Hartford, Connecticut. Lisa, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I was the mother of twins, born just short of 23 weeks. And my husband and I, in consultation with our very good doctors at Yale New Haven Hospital, decided not to take any extraordinary steps. And we felt that was the right thing to do for our twins who did pass away.
Mm-hmm.
But I was very grateful to the doctors who were very thoughtful and very honest. And as a mother, one of the concerns that I had was that the chance of a really successful, healthy outcome for either of our twins was very low. And the fact that the doctors were very honest with us about the fact that the medical intervention at that stage may actually be very painful for these infants. And we don't really know if that's the case or not, but that was a lot to bear at that time. And I do feel, as hard as it was, that we made the right decision.
So these years later, because of the risks there, but it must have been very hard to make that in the moment, Lisa.
It was terribly difficult, and it's still difficult to think about now. So what I was grateful for was the fact that our doctors were very honest, and at least at that time, what they told us was that our twins had 70% or higher chance of being very, very profoundly disabled, perhaps being wheelchair-bound, perhaps being unable to feed themselves as a permanent condition, and other disabilities that might have also been part of their future. And that seemed like an awful lot to put them through. So that's the way we made that decision.
Lisa, I appreciate your sharing that experience with us. It's also illuminating. Dr. Mercurio, we have this sense of hospitals sometimes being just gung-ho for treatment, and maybe not as gung-ho for these full conversations and looking down the road. I mean, when the risks of disability are so high, how does that get fully conveyed? And as an ethicist, how do you factor that large risk into the conversation?
I would say that the sense that hospitals were gung-ho for treatment at 22 or 23 weeks is probably a misperception. There was a study done a few years back of the 20 largest intensive care units in New Jersey. It's, you know, it's 20 mm-hmm. intensive care units, so it's and about one out of three, 30% of those intensive care units were willing to try at 22 weeks if that's what the parents wanted. There was no hospital that would insist on doing it. I'm not aware of any hospital that insists on resuscitating at 22 weeks over parental objections. Even at 23 weeks, the general sense within the profession is that at 23 and even up to 24 in some places, parents should be given some latitude. So I think that if there's a sense that hospitals are extremely gung-ho and pushing forward over parental objections at 22 or 23 weeks, I think that's very unlikely to be the case.
Now, I don't want to give the impression in this particular arena of neonatology, but sometimes overall we look at hospitals and the concern is, you know, are they looking at delivering services or the welfare of the individual patient? And sometimes you wonder about the business case and so on. I understand in this case, in this arena, that may not be. You say it's not what's driving people. But in the back of people's minds, you just wonder. Darcy in Newton, Massachusetts. Darcy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi. What's your story?
So the reason I'm calling, I have a wonderful 17-year-old daughter who was born at 28 weeks gestation.
Okay.
And she's an absolute blessing. But my child has struggled with learning disabilities her entire life. And even though I'm in Newton, Massachusetts, one of the better school districts, I think, you know, in the country, they still don't really have the type of resources necessary to treat so many kids like my daughter because they don't understand the uniqueness, the likelihood of the learning disabilities, and sometimes the very type. I'm wondering if there's any efforts being made to educate our educators, if you will, of the likely special needs of these kids going forward.
Jennifer Needle, let me bring that to you, if I may.
I think Dr. Bell or Dr. Mercurio may be more adept at answering that question simply because they are more focused on the neonatal arena. So I'll defer to them to answer that question for the caller.
But your kids, the kids you treat are closer to school age.
That's right. So I take care of essentially survivors of prematurity in the pediatric intensive care unit if they have complex medical needs. And we are seeing a rising proportion of children admitted to the pediatric intensive care units across the country. The data is pretty stark. It's more than 50% of children with complex medical problems. Now, not all of those children with complex medical problems are the result of prematurity. I want to be very clear about that. But we are certainly seeing an increasing population of children in both pediatric hospitals in general, but also pediatric intensive care units that have specialized and critical needs related to being survivors of prematurity. And so I think part of what I find important about this conversation is that talking about survival after resuscitation at 22 and 23 weeks is one issue. Talking about survival and long-term sequelae, long-term consequences of surviving prematurity and what that means for the child and the family in the long term when the child is school age, teenage, and even adulthood is an important question that we need to be engaging in this country.
Dr. Bell, I think I heard you say earlier that we shouldn't presume a lower bound of weeks at which viability may be seen. I mean, back in the 60s, people talked about 30-plus weeks. In the 70s, as you were saying, you know, late 20, 28 weeks. Now we're talking perhaps 23, perhaps 22. But does your specialty take into account the lifelong implications of these decisions beyond the survival in the immediate or the first few years, Dr. Bell?
Yes, very much so. At the University of Iowa, the neonatologists follow the children for several years, sometimes even to school age. And in the Neonatal Research Network, we do follow-up studies quite often to school age. I find the concept of a threshold of viability to be not such a useful idea. I think it's of more interest to politicians and lawyers. I think for neonatologists, we still have to look at this on a case-by-case basis with the parents involved, because there is so much more to this than just the gestational age at the time of birth. It's a good place to begin, but I think, as Dr. Mercurio said, there are so many other things that go into this. That doesn't make it any easier, but we have to be aware of all of this.
I mean, you say it's not useful to talk about threshold of viability. On the other hand, here's Dr. Needle in St. Paul, who's seeing more and more children with complex medical problems. And some portion of that looks to her attributable to very early birth. That would seem to have that seems worthy of consideration, both for those children, for their families, maybe for society broadly. Dr. Bell.
Well, it's true, and the fact remains that these are children who are going to have a full lifetime ahead of them, and that applies not only to the good results of our treatment, but also the less good results. It's been studied, and it's well known now that if we look at very premature babies and we look at children or adults with the exact same prognosis for survival or disability, and we ask physicians or nurses or lay people how they would rate these in terms of priority, the premature baby usually ends up at the bottom of the list. We very rarely have discussions about whether we should be treating adults with a 30% chance of survival and a chance of long-term complications. But we do have these discussions about premature babies, and I think it's an issue of justice that perhaps Dr. Mercurio or Dr. Needle would be prepared to address.
We'll look at that. One more call first, if I may. Ron in Janesville, Wisconsin. Ron, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I've got to ask the insensitive question that I haven't heard yet, and that would be who pays for all this? And if the child outlives the parents, then what happens then?
Dr. Mercurio?
Sure. Well, who pays for it? The short answer is, of course, the entire society at some level pays for it. in terms of, if I assume we're at this point, we're talking about money. Because obviously there's costs here to the family and the child and to the society and the school system and the pediatric intensive care unit beyond just money. But I think that what the caller's getting at is that this is going to have a price tag to it, and no doubt. And at some level, of course, it's going to depend on how much insurance a patient has. So there's the short-term costs in the intensive care unit. And then the longer-term costs, if the child is left with a severe disability, there could be obviously many, many years of ongoing costs to the family and possibly to society as well. So that is, I think, an issue at some point. I do think it should be looked at in the same way, perhaps, as we look at other people. But that's the interesting question, which Dr. Bell alluded to.
Well, that goes to the justice issue. Is it the same looking at an adult with a 30% chance of survival and a very premature baby who, through medical wonders, we have a chance at saving? Do you put those on the same scales when you weigh the justice of dramatic intervention?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I would – the answer is maybe. It's a complex question, except to say that, bear in mind, we have the adult if we had an adult patient who had a 30% chance of survival, again, this is usually through modern medical techniques that we can do this. Now we have a 30% chance of survival and a significant risk of long-term disability in some setting. And we have a newborn and we have a 10-year-old child. Should we look at these differently? What I would suggest is that if we're going to treat people differently, we need to identify a morally relevant difference. So should premature babies have a different moral status or moral standing than older children or adults? That's the huge question. I think that the burden is on those who would say that one person should be treated differently than another, assuming the same prognosis. But Ed Bell pointed out a very important data that we tend, as a group just within the medical profession and outside, to see babies, particularly premature babies, as something different. And there's all sorts of interesting psychological reasons why that might be, and as well as philosophical reasons. But to get to the point of the cost, it's a big cost that society is going to share.
We're out of time right there, Dr. McCurry, and I'm sorry for that. Just scratching the surface here as this age goes down and down. Dr. Mark Mercurio, Dr. Edward Bell, Dr. Jennifer Needle, our thanks to all three of you for joining us today. Thank you so much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.